Yeah, if everything that is easy for most e-commerce brands tends to get really difficult as soon as you mention cannabis.
Hello and welcome to Clicked Off. Every week we'll be hearing from the people making it big in e-commerce. I'm your host, Jason Chappell. Joining me today, I have got Matt McNeil, who is the co-founder of Chloris and general entrepreneur, man with a Midas touch, it seems. You know, maybe Matt, we should get into that first. Let's talk about you. But welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
So, look, you have an extensive history. Maybe that I've just kind of alluded to there. You are a man who is a 4 times founder. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yep.
talk me through this, because Chloris is your latest venture. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, that's my sort of full time. Yeah, takes up the vast majority of my time these days. But yeah, it's the latest in a sort of line of different things. I've effectively never really worked for anyone else. Other than that, or an exit for a brief period.
So let's start with Chloris, because really that's what we're here to talk about, you know, today. We'd love to get to know a little bit more about, you know, the man behind it. But talk to me about Chloris.
So at its heart, Chloris is a natural wellness company. So it was started by myself and my two co-founders, who are sort of long-term friends of mine. And we initially started with CBD being the main focus of the company. We'd all come to using CBD for various different sort of personal and family health issues, really. And we started Chloris comparatively early, I guess, in the sort of CBD revolution. So we actually founded it back in 2018, started selling to the public in 2019. So quite early doors in the CBD world. And it was really driven by a need for a quality brand that was based on good scientific principles, and we also wanted to do things in a really sustainable way. But at the core of what we do is making effective products in a sustainable manner that are a real joy for people to use. That was our sort of founding mission.
Mm-hmm. I mean, 2018, I didn't realize that was quite early. I mean, I started initially using, you know, some CBD products in, you know, about 2019, and I had no idea that this was something that was relatively new. You know, is it that it's been much bigger elsewhere in the world and it's new to the UK? I mean, because obviously it's been around a while.
It has been. So it's been legal for quite a while, but actually you didn't really start to see any sort of major traction until, I would say, yeah, 2018 was early doors when it started to sort of really sort of become into the public consciousness. And you had a long period where it's very difficult to get, you know, reliable quality products. There was a lot of misinformation in the market, a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, what wasn't a good product, even what wasn't legal. And things have developed, I guess, from a regulatory standpoint, relatively quickly, not as fast as they should do. And there's still a huge way to go, and particularly if you go beyond CBD into looking at other cannabis-derived compounds and things like that, there's still a long way to go. But that sort of surge into public consciousness really, I would say, yeah, started to gain proper momentum probably 2019.
Maybe it's a good time to jump into the regulation side of things, because you have some pretty unique challenges, you know, in your sector that lots of other brands don't face. Now, you are completely legal, you know, in the UK, where we are based right now, entirely legal, and people can purchase this, you know, without having to go and do some dodgy deals with cash down some alleyways. But what are the kind of regulatory challenges that you're facing?
I mean, there are a lot, and it depends on the type of product, what you want to do with it. There's a lot of misunderstanding around those regulations, even amongst the agencies that are involved with it, and it gets quite complicated because it touches so many different areas of the law as well, and so many different agencies. So depending on your product type, you might have regulations imposed by the Food Standards Agency, but then everything also comes down to Home Office regulations as well. And then you've got potentially regulations on the Misuse of Drugs Act as well. Lots of different things sort of start to come into play. The key reason for a lot of the complication here is THC, which is the other compound regularly found in cannabis. That's the side that gets you high. CBD doesn't get you high. CBD to be legally sold in the UK is coming from hemp, which is a naturally low THC form of cannabis. So it has to be hemp derived. It's naturally got very little THC in there to actually be legally on the shelves. You effectively have to have no THC at all in the product, and that's where a lot of the sticking points in legislation come from, because depending on which you read or which legislation you follow, like legally you can have up to a milligram of THC in a consumer package. So if that's a 10 mil bottle, it's a barely detectable amount of THC in there. But then if you talk to some people in the Home Office, then as far as they're concerned, like, it's impossible to produce a legal CBD product. But that's patently false. It is absolutely possible to legally produce it. There's a judicial case going on right now about a firm that was trying to import stuff that was below that level, and it got impounded by the Home Office and caused all kinds of issues. So there is still a lot of miscommunication and problems throughout the chain. And you've got some people that are still pushing to try and classify CBD as a medical product, despite the fact that the MHRA put out a statement as far back as 2017 saying, as far as they're concerned, it's a food supplement, not a medical substance. But and this isn't just the UK, it all plays back sort of internationally. And it's because ultimately CBD is derived from the cannabis plant, and that cannabis plant has a long and varied history. I mean, if you go right back, like, humans have been using cannabis for thousands of years. And not only cannabis in the form that a lot of people associate it with in terms of the THC and getting high, but cannabis in terms of hemp. I mean, George Washington owned hemp farms and grew hemp, and it's been a staple crop for millennia. Mm-hmm. But in more recent times, it's become much more stigmatized, much more demonized. It's less than 100 years that it's been illegal. And if you look at the evidence, there is no good reason for it ever having been prohibited in the way it was, and all of that research coming out now just goes to back that up. It would never be made illegal, I don't think, in this day and age. There's no evidence to support that. But because it has been, and the way it was made illegal, it lumped anything that came from cannabis in the same bucket. So whether it was hemp and very low THC and is just absolutely not going to get you high, or whether it was cannabis that had been bred for high THC and commonly sort of referred to as marijuana, or that's a largely made up term, and they've all been stuck in the same bucket, and that's had global consequences on what can be done with cannabis, which is a real shame, because it's phenomenally beneficial crop.
I saw a really interesting article that was saying that there was a big switch away from hemp and hemp products. You mentioning, was it George Washington that you mentioned who had?
Yeah, he owned hemp farms.
There was a big push politically in the US to move away from hemp, because they were looking at it to produce paper and fabrics and these sorts of things. And there was a big movement, obviously, by the people who owned forests, trees and those sorts of things, to push towards the production of paper through wood rather than via hemp, because obviously it worked for them financially, and they somehow managed to get some sort of policies in place that really pushed that. The world could have gone in a completely different direction had that not happened.
Absolutely, and I think you'll find it the same story. It plays into cotton farming. It also plays into the story of prohibition. It's very, very murky. There's no real solid scientific basis for ever having made it restricted. And unfortunately, the consequences of that still exist to this day. So you can get a license to farm hemp in the UK, but you have to destroy the flower on site. And the flower is the most valuable part of the plant. So it makes it, in most cases, uneconomical to grow it in the UK, despite the fact that it's a hugely beneficial crop. Not only have you got the CBD and other cannabinoids that you can extract from it, but it can be used, like you said, for fabrics, for paper, building materials. There's a lot of examples now. Like it's an incredibly good alternative to concrete. But most of that, until the legislation changes in the UK, it's never going to happen.
That's fascinating. And it's really fast growing and sustainable. Like there's a lot of good that can be done.
Yeah. It will grow pretty much anywhere. Incredibly good for the soil as well. So it's a remediator. It will suck up sort of pollutants in the soil help to sort of clean up polluted ground as well. There's so many potential benefits for it. But because of the interplay of the laws, like particularly in the UK, it's really difficult for anyone to farm it and make money from it in the UK right now. And trying to unpick that process is going to take quite a long time, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that in order to get your hands on product, you have to import this from somewhere.
So the ironic thing is we have to import the extract. So we work predominantly with hemp farms in Europe, a few in the US and Canada as well, but predominantly Europe. So we have to bring in the extract from there because you can't grow and extract CBD in the UK. So arguably one of the highest sort of value parts of the chain has to be done out of the country. We bring the extract in and then we do all of the rest of our manufacturing in the UK. But frustratingly, the one thing we can't do is farm and extract the raw ingredient that a lot of our products need.
Okay. Now, this regulation doesn't just kind of stop at production and that side of things for you. It rolls into advertising and everything else. Am I right?
Yeah, frustratingly. So again, all of these things are largely interlinked, but in essence, advertising on a lot of the major platforms that most e-commerce brands would use, so Facebook, Google, TikTok, is largely closed to us. Like you can't market CBD products or anything sort of hemp-derived, cannabis-derived on those platforms.
I guess it may be the million-dollar question then. How do you go about growing a business in the CBD space? Because this is not uncompetitive, right? There's a lot of people operating in this space now.
Yeah, I think I will say that I think the space has consolidated a lot recently because a lot of people moved into this space because they saw the benefits of the product, but then a lot of people thought there was a quick buck to be made there as well. And it's a very difficult space to operate in because a lot of those channels are just not available. So we've had to go back to old school tactics, really. Look at what you would do to build a brand the long-term way. So going back to sort of more traditional channels like PR, referrals, we can do some stuff in forms with, I hate the term influencers, but we do that on a sort of more micro basis. But for us, it's been going back to one of the basics of a brand. Like if advertising is not really an option, what else can we do to raise awareness? And a large chunk of that comes back to just creating the best possible product so that people want to talk about it as well. So we had to go back to like the real basics. Which I like as well because it means that we're going back to fundamentals. Like we're trying to build a solid business that is benefiting everyone through the chain rather than just something that we can very cheaply advertise en masse, sell some product and then get out. It's never been about that for us. So from a brand standpoint, it's an obstacle, but it's not a reason not to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I think we met and we had a coffee the other week because rather fortuitously, we don't actually live that far from one another. And we were talking about, constraints and them actually providing opportunity, when you can't operate in certain areas or you can't do certain things, you kind of really have to sharpen your pencil elsewhere. Where have you seen success, in terms of being able to build and grow that business?
So in the early days, and to some extent still now, like education is a huge part of what we do. And that really helps in the beginning, sort of playing into our relationships with the press and building the brand that way, but helping to increase the public understanding of what CBD is, what cannabis is, where the health benefits of that are. And then eventually that was playing into other natural substances as well. So going down that traditional route of working with the media and trying to build that customer education that's where we first started from. And that is it's a much more long-term process you know, it, months to years to really build momentum in that, because it's about building that trust, building that relationship, and you can't just throw money in it like you can with advertising and increase reach that way. So it was a slower start, but that's really held us in good stead now in terms of brand building, because like I say, it's going back to the basics of how you build a solid brand.
And you've got some partnerships in place that I see. You know, you have, you know, some supplies that you put into hotels and spas and these sorts of things. That's right, yeah?
Yes, that's right. So we're really fortunate in that we have our products and branded treatments in spas and hotels like Nobu, Six Senses, Bulgari, Rosewood London, and Wentworth Club, sort of private members clubs as well, both in the UK and now increasingly internationally. And that's been a core part of our strategy again, is to both increase the reach of our products, put it into places where people can really like experience it and get a positive benefit from the product, and also positioning our brand in that sort of premium space. Because part of what we wanted to build with Chloris from the outset was a brand that people are, that they're proud to own, they're happy to talk about. Talk about it as if you were to take Aesop and turn it into a wellness brand, if they made health products, that's where we want to be in that sort of that status.
And you're bucking a bit of a trend for lots of brands. You have a bricks and mortar store in
London, don't you? Yeah, and we opened that basically as the pandemic restrictions were lifting, partly because pre-pandemic, we did a lot of events. We found that they were really helpful and a lot of really good conversations with people, and it played into our education angle. We found people had questions, they really wanted to talk to someone about it and feel like they're getting a knowledgeable answer, and wanted to be able to experience the products themselves to understand it. And we looked at, well, how, obviously we couldn't do that during the pandemic, so we had to lean back on online, but as things started to reopen, we looked at, well, what are our opportunities to actually do this in a more meaningful way and in a permanent way? And that evolved, and it went from, like, oh, let's look at whether we can do some pop-ups, to actually we ended up opening our full-on retail store in the Carnaby district of London. So some of the most prime retail estate in the world, but we felt that fitted the brand. It really helped us to open it up to a much wider audience and start having those conversations on a regular basis. And from a point of view of being able to interact with customers and potential customers and really hear their questions, hear how they're talking about their needs, and being able to feed that back into the brand, it's been absolutely invaluable.
And how do you start to feed that back into your online experience? Because not everybody can hit the store in Carnaby Street. How do you make sure that people are getting a similar experience and really benefiting from the brand, you know, online?
It's largely taking what we learn from the customer experience in store and then seeing how we can apply that through all of our channels. So listening to how our customers phrase the questions, what products they're asking about, how they're relaying their experience, and then making sure that we can mirror that language and how they convey their needs into our online experience. And we've now started taking that through into actually creating interactive video experiences on the website that mirror the way that we interact with customers in store. So asking the same kind of questions, guiding them through the range in the same way, and really trying to make that as close to the in-store experience as we can do online. Like I say, it's all about educating the customer, making them feel heard, and importantly, making sure that we guide them to the right kind of products that are going to have a result for them. Because for us, it's all about making sure that customers have a positive result. We don't want to be selling them something that isn't going to work for them, or where they don't understand how to use it to get the most benefit. For us, it's really important that we show them to the right thing and we get them using it in the right way and that they have a great experience with it.
CBD is one of those products that it's not going to be like an instant result. You know, you get your product and you take one dose of CBD and then all of a sudden all your ailments are fixed. It's one of those things that builds over time, right?
Exactly. And the experience is, it's very individual as well. So we've all got an endocannabinoid system, which is what CBD interacts with, but everyone's system behaves differently. Everyone's effect and experience with CBD is going to be different. So some people, depending on the product, will feel an effect really, really quickly, like minutes, seconds, even in some instances. But with other people, it can take much longer, sort of 30, 60, 90 days, potentially, depending on what they're looking for, what they're taking, how they're taking it. So it's really trying to convey that to people and not have people coming in expecting, oh, this is a magic fix, because it's very much helping the body to help itself. It's not a quick sort of pharmaceutical fix. This is should be thought of much more like a supplement and a long-term way of helping out the body.
See, I think that's really interesting, because I don't know, as a society, and I see this particularly in my kids, right, that we've been conditioned for instant gratification, and that everything that we do will be instant, and that we don't have to watch adverts and we can watch everything on demand. I mean, I took my kids to round to my mum's a little while back, and they wanted to watch some TV, and she just has regular TV, for want of a better term, and they had to sit there and watch what was on at that moment in time, and it absolutely fried their brains, because they're saying, okay, yeah, that's fine, but I want to watch this other program, right? But that's not on. You can watch this program, or we can change channels and you can watch this program. And then some adverts came on, and my son said to me, he's 4, he says, I don't want to watch grown-up TV, and I don't want to watch this. And they were just adverts in between what was going on. I don't think he'd ever experienced watching an advert before. It feels really counterintuitive, but also quite liberating to want to maybe slow down a bit in what we're doing, and also just accept that some things take a bit of time.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And I think it is, it's important for people to realize that and yeah, not keep looking for the quick fixes, but actually looking for something that's going to help in the long term, but hopefully help in a more sort of sustainable and natural way as well. And we do see a lot of people come to us who are looking for alternatives to pharmaceuticals and things like that. And so I think there's quite an openness to that, but there's a large segment who have this, you know, misunderstanding or still conflate CBD with expecting to get high in some way, and it's just not the way that it works. And also trying to convey that fact that it is such an individual thing as well. So it's quite interesting messaging, but we try and sort of encourage people to think of it like, if you were taking a vitamin supplement, if you're taking vitamin C, then you're not expecting to sort of take it and then immediately feel a difference. It's that long-term effect, and helping the body to get back into balance is ultimately what CBD is doing. And that will take time, and it's a worthwhile investment for people, because ultimately the thing that drives us as a brand is the feedback that we get from our customers. So as I said, like, all of our products we design from an efficacy standpoint, and so for us, actually hearing back from customers, is this doing what you wanted, like, how was your experience with it, that's what drives everything that we do. And so, you know, we know that these products are having great effects for people, especially when they realize that, you know, okay, this takes a little bit of time to take effect. And again, that it plays into all our messaging. It plays in the way that we sort of try and set up the customer expectations as well. And even to when we ask for feedback on the products as well, we need to sort of give it time to really take effect.
And I guess, at what point do you find that people are coming to you? You know, are they coming to you with particular issues they're trying to solve, or is it that they're coming from more of a wellness perspective? You know, how does that work?
It's a very interesting question. So we're a wellness brand. We're not a medical brand, so we're not selling things that we're not claiming to cure anything. These are all products that are designed to sort of help enhance people's well-being. But we find that typically people come to us for one of a number of reasons, and they gravitate towards CBD or other sort of natural plant-based products because they want an alternative to big pharma sort of single compound solutions. I think there's a growing awareness that things aren't as simple as one molecule is going to do this particular thing for you. There is a more natural approach to this. And what we generally find is that the categories that people come to us looking for are things like sleep, it's aches and pains, sort of recovery from workouts and all of the other sort of associated aches and pains that you tend to get. Sort of stress and sort of helping find that moment of calm is a big driver towards CBD. Increasingly, like we've got a growing range that helps with sort of menopause symptoms as well, and that's not just CBD, that's other natural compounds too. And then a big driver for us recently has been skincare and the role that CBD can actually play in sort of helping interact with the skin and calm redness and things like that as well.
So it is a really holistic product, you know, in terms of its versatility to be able to enhance people's well-being.
Yeah, it's quite an amazing compound, really. And that's it's a real benefit in a way, but also it's quite a challenge to communicate that to people. And when you start to see that, oh, CBD could help with this, and I see people using it for that as well, and you look back and think, well, how could it possibly help for all of these different things? How can it help my skin feel cold, but also then help mitigate inflammation potentially, or how can it help me get a better night's rest? But all of these things sort of they're all deeply interconnected, and it all comes back to our body's endocannabinoid system, which is a signaling network in the body that is actually it's throughout the body, and it's a really important system in the body that helps regulate that messaging between your hormone system and your nervous system. And it plays a really important role in inflammation, in sleep, in mood control, appetite, huge variety of different things. And CBD is working with that system to bring it back into balance, to sort of help the messenger chemicals that are in that system get back to the sort of naturally balanced levels, because when they're out of balance, that's when it tends to manifest in all of these different kinds of issues. And CBD is just helping that system to restore order, in effect, which is why it has such a broad range of effects. And that system is not only in the brain, but it's all throughout the body. It's all throughout your muscles, your joints, all over, and you have different receptors for it throughout those, which is why it has such a broad range of different effects, and why you can apply it to the skin and get one effect, or you can sort of take it as drops under the tongue or as gummies and things like that, and get a different effect entirely. So it's a really quite miraculous compound, and the fact that it's been relatively closed to science for such a long time, because it was prohibited. It was viewed as anything derived from cannabis was viewed as you can't touch this, and therefore that had a huge knock-on effect on medical research. And now, as that's starting to open up, only really since the late 90s, what it's unveiled is phenomenal. And the fact that that system in the body is called the endocannabinoid system, because the body is producing its own cannabinoids, the same compounds that you find in this plant. So to restrict research in that plant is practically criminal.
Do you know what? It's fascinating. And the more I kind of dig into this side of things, the more interesting it is, because you have other areas as well, like mushrooms, that we are only at, once again, because like ancient civilizations knew the benefits of some of these plants, and we've lost them or criminalized them because people have misused them. But looking into how they've used, mushrooms, or how they're now starting to, look at treating people with PTSD by giving them like LSD and these sorts of things is absolutely fascinating. And something that it feels like we shut down because as a society, we were scared of what it could do. And I mean, we joke in my household about there's this perception between, my parents' generation and their parents, that cannabis in particular is a gateway drug, seen as a gateway drug, and anything associated with it will obviously mean that if you take, CBD or you smoke marijuana or anything like this, then obviously you're going to go on to do cocaine and heroin and, all of these other really horrendous things.
Yeah.
It's just not true.
No, in fact, there's a big piece of research that came out, I think it was just this week, that completely debunks that theory. They've actually done a serious piece of research on that whole, like, the gateway drug idea. And yeah, it's nonsense. There is zero evidence to support it. It's just not the case. In fact, I'd argue it's probably more the sort of inverse of that. By making cannabis illegal in the way it has been, and you create perverse incentives in the rest of the supply chain. So if you're going to go to prison for selling cannabis at a relatively low profit margin, you might as well sell heroin or cocaine because you're going to make more money. So it completely perverts the whole system.
And in the UK, obviously cannabis is still illegal, but other parts of the world, you know, parts of the US and Canada, they've legalized cannabis. How does that play out in a kind of global situation, and then also affecting, you know, brands like yours that have no THC in, so people aren't getting high? Is there a correlation between those things?
I mean, I think they're very different use cases. So I would say, legalizing cannabis in general, like I'm for it. I think it is the right thing to do. I think, like, the amount, if you look at the amount of money we waste, the amount of tax opportunity that is wasted by legalizing it, by not legalizing it, the opportunity is huge if it was opened up. And I just mean that from a benefit to society basis. I think there's only net gain to be had there if it's done in the right manner. Because right now, the situation is kind of a joke. I mean, effectively in London, it's all but decriminalized anyway, because the police are not going after people for possession. You see people openly smoking on the streets and things. It's not an issue. Whereas if you go to some regions up north, like, you'll end up with a prison term if you're caught with the same amount. So that is fundamentally wrong anyway. There should be equality of law throughout the UK either way. But the police don't have the resources.
Let's not get started on the police.
Yeah. The situation is untenable. But I think it's important not to conflate the two things. Like, use of CBD as a sort of wellness compound is very different to recreational use of cannabis. I think you'll have a lot of people who still want the positive benefits of using CBD, but they don't want the high, and they don't want the sort of psychotropic effects of using THC. There's definitely a market for both. I think they're quite different, but they're undoubtedly people that, from a, you know, a medical standpoint, could benefit hugely from better access to medical cannabis. Now, in theory, it's been available on the NHS since, I think, like 2019. There was a report out the other day, less than 5 prescriptions have been issued by the NHS for medical cannabis.
Across the whole of the UK?
Across the whole of the UK. Now, on a private basis, I think it's more than 30,000. But the problem is that on a private basis, if you've got a private cannabis prescription, you're talking thousands of pounds a month to access that as a medicine. Because the legal supply side is so small, it becomes incredibly expensive to do. And the amount of legislation that you have to comply with if you want to be a medical cannabis supplier is phenomenal. So you've got a really high fixed cost right now and a very small user base, because access is incredibly difficult. And so all of these people are missing out from the benefit. I think there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people in the UK who would have a substantially better standard of living if they could have access to medicinal cannabis. And that's not to get them high, that's to treat medical conditions. And this would make a huge difference to their quality of life. And yet the law means that they don't have open access to it. And that is frankly ridiculous.
Now, let's bring it back to the brand side of things, and the business side of things. You are obviously operating, you know, in a market that is largely neglected by lots of, you know, advertising.
If everything that is easy for most e-commerce brands tends to get really difficult as soon as you mention cannabis.
So, but you must face similar issues to some of these brands, you know. What are those issues as you kind of see them?
It's access to the basic things that you generally these days take for granted in e-commerce. So even access to clearing payments, like credit cards, that kind of thing is you have to go to a specialist provider who's willing to take that risk. Now, that's getting easier, but it's still far from perfect. So we use Shopify, like love Shopify as a platform. We can't access their payments infrastructure because largely it's based out of the US. And a lot of this comes back down to the fact that most of the infrastructure for these things, payment infrastructure for Google, Facebook, Shopify, it's all stemming out of the US. In the US, because cannabis is still federally illegal, most of the big banks don't want to touch it because they could potentially be pursued for a federal crime because they're moving money for cannabis across state lines. That trickles back into everything. So it makes life phenomenally difficult for even the basic things. So a lot of those tools are just not open to us. First conversation I have to have with a lot of suppliers is, we're in this space, can you even help us? We still get, I had one of the big neobanks reach out to us the other day, desperate for our business. I just had to be like, before we go any further, go and talk to your risk department. This is what we do. Can you help us? They come back 2 days later. No, sorry, we can't. And that happens time and time again. It's not going to change until things change on a more global level, because all of these, like Visa, MasterCard, those kind of things, they all, they're global companies. Until this is a simple thing for them to do on a global basis, that it's going to be tricky.
But as a user, I can come on and I can use my MasterCard or my Visa or whatever on your store, and they'll transact. Yeah.
Yeah, we've managed to get around that, but we still have a lot more restrictions than most other businesses would. So international trade is really difficult for us. So for example, with CBD-based products, because of the US legislation, generally you can't clear US credit cards unless you have a US entity. And so everything's got to go through in the US if you want to trade there. Just one example, but it's the same with a lot of Europe. Like despite the fact that CBD is considered legal in Europe, some individual countries have different legislations about it and do not permit the sale there. So again, that blows back into payment infrastructure, delivery, getting shipments cross-border is really tricky. There's a lot of obstacles to international trade in particular.
Okay. And look, we are fast-headed towards Q4 right now, and this is a big time of year for brands everywhere. What have you got planned? Moving into Q4, does it change operationally, like sort of what you do?
We definitely see an increase in orders around this whole period. So we do start to look at our assortment in terms of what is applicable to more sort of gifting. So we have a core range of products which people tend to use for their sort of ongoing core needs, and then we have ancillary products to that which are, they fit more within that gifting sphere. So things like our bathing range is really, really popular this time of year. So we do bath salts, we do body oils, which all play on the sort of calming, relieving aspects of CBD, but they're also, they're a really luxurious consumer experience. So we tend to put more emphasis on those lines at this time of year. Obviously, our retail store is a big play for us this time of year, that we get a lot of foot traffic around that. And then it's really, it's encouraging our customers who are usually buying for themselves. It's to sort of think about others and loved ones and how these products might enhance their quality of life as well.
Okay, cool. And is there anything that's kind of coming up for you, both personally and professionally, Matt?
What's next? we've always got big plans. So I would say professionally for us, it's all about that educational content. We've only scratched the surface of taking that store experience and moving that online. So that's a big driver for us right now. And really personalizing that customer experience as well. So taking what we know about customers and then helping to guide them to the right product assortment, the right routines that we suggest. And that's like an ongoing feedback loop as well, because then we want to hear from those customers what's working for them, what's not, how can we tweak that? How can we constantly improve that experience? And underlying all of that, that feeds back into our product development. That also feeds back into our sustainability initiatives. And we're constantly looking at how can we make everything that we do that bit better? How can we improve our packaging? How can we improve our logistics? How can we improve every single aspect that is sort of utilizing resources to make that as efficient as possible?
That's cool. And at the beginning, I mean, let's circle back a little bit. I mentioned you are multiple founder. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You know, talk me through some of these businesses that you are and have been involved in.
Okay, so if we go back into the dim and distant past, I started my first business while I was still doing my A-levels, which was back in the late 90s, the very late 90s, I should say, not to take myself too much.
You shave a few years off there, yeah.
I threw a weird series of coincidences and just random luck, I ended up producing websites for the music industry at the time. So house DJs DJs like Juz Jules, Pete Tong, they were all customers of mine when I was 17. And I ended up sort of parlaying that into building my own web agency.
I'm gonna stop you. How did you even pick up people like that? They're big names. For people who aren't aware, they're big names or were big names.
So right place, right time. So if you want the full story, is quite bizarre, but I was a geek in school. I loved computers. Yeah, I loved design. I loved playing around with these things. And I saw an ad to like test some of the very, very first web design software. And they were after students in particular at the time to sort of try and test this out. And I got onto that program. They sent me the software and they're like, all we want you to do is make a website. And I was like, okay, what can I do here? And I literally just like, this is going to date me now. I was walking through Woolworths near my school and they had all the CD singles up there. And I saw there was a Natalie Imbruglia had just released Torn. And I literally just picked up that single and went, oh, that looks quite cool. I was like, I'll do a website as a little fan website for this. I put it up, I didn't really think anything of it. And it blew up. It was literally getting hundreds of thousands of visits. It got a load of press. I don't know why. To this day, I really don't understand why. I've still got a copy of that site somewhere. This is like when the image tag was like the new thing in HTML. And one day out of the blue, I get an email from this guy who was like, oh, we saw this website. I found it because Natalie Imbruglia just poached our guitarist for her world tour. We're in a band. We've got no money, but we've just been signed by a record label. If you could do our website, I'll introduce you to the record label. And I was 17 and I was you know, doing this at home. I was like, hell yeah, that sounds amazing. So I built them a website and they, you know, true to their word, sort of paid for my train ticket down to London from the north. I grew up in Crewe. Introduced me to the record label, and it turned out it was the record label that had just been started by Juz Jules at the time. And before I knew it, I parlayed that into doing the record label website, Juz Jules' website. I ended up finishing my A-levels, taking what was supposed to be a year off before going to university and then never going. Everything sort of snowballed from there, and that became an agency. And then in the early noughties, that I was doing a lot of work for Richard Branson's record label at the time, and I saw an opportunity to build some software that would improve some things in what record labels in general were doing. And that eventually became a software as a service platform that was in the sort of email and marketing automation space back when software as a service wasn't really a term. Started that in 2003. Built that for 10 years, sold that to a private equity roll-up that then got sold to GoDaddy. And I spent a couple of years in there and then built up their managed services division. So building websites for small businesses on mass. Mm-hmm. Left that, moved to Australia, started an agency with my old, so the software company had an office in Australia, but when I sold it, I bought that back. And we turned that into an agency, which then went on to become one of Klaviyo's largest partners outside of the US. And all we did was customer journeys for D2C brands. And we just did the email part. We did it really, really well. And we just obsessed over what does that customer experience look like once you have someone's email address? How do you turn them into a customer? How do you turn them into a repeat customer? And how do you make that happen? I'm really fortunate to work with some amazing brands in Australia. And I got that sort of that bug of like, I love this. I love doing the strategy for these brands, but I really want to be working on something that, you know, I own all of the the pieces on. I can sort of work on every single aspect of this. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something that was a net benefit for everyone. So it had to have a positive impact on the customers. We had to be able to do it in a sustainable way. And Chloris sort of evolved. I had that desire, and then my friends had the idea for it. So Kim and Pedram, who are my dear friends and my co-founders, still run Chloris together today. And they had the idea. We got chatting about it. I was originally just supposed to be an investor and an advisor on it. And very rapidly, it sort of sucked me in, became my full-time passion, and I ended up moving back to the UK to work on it full-time just before the world shut down.
Oh, wow. But do you know what? I've spoken to so many people over the last few years who have avoided, you know, being somewhere or just moved somewhere almost by the skin of their teeth, not by design, because nobody knew what was coming. I mean, I was in New York just before the world shut down, and I was there for work. I didn't have family there. I don't know what I would have done had I been kind of stuck. It's laughable now because I think back to it. And when I entered the US, the question was, have you been to China in the last 2 weeks? The answer was no. I was fine. You could go in.
I had exactly the same experience because I went to a cannabis conference in Las Vegas and I got back 3 days before lockdown hit. And yeah, very, very similar. And I remember going to Vegas at the time thinking, this isn't looking great. Like things seem to be getting more and more dodgy. And yeah, no one seems to be quite taking this seriously yet. But I get the impression that things are about to go south. And that was my last trip abroad for quite a while.
It's strange what's happened in the world, you know, over the last, we're approaching 4 years now, which is terrifying that we're still talking about it as much as we are, you know, nearly half a decade on from this happening.
I think that the impact is beyond what anyone really anticipates. I think what we're seeing now is that now it's the societal impact that's the ongoing thing, I think, like, you know, above and beyond this. The economy and all of the shakeout there, it's that long-term impact on the way we all interact and people's expectations as well, I think.
Well, I mean, look at us. We're sitting here and we're doing a video call, recording a podcast rather than sitting in person.
Yeah, actually, just before the pandemic was the last, I did a podcast recording in person, and that was the last time I'd done one, actually sat in a studio with someone.
It's mad, isn't it? I mean, and it's not very often. You know, I've had a few people on the podcast. I've met a few of them in person, which has been really nice. But then others, you know, I haven't. I also, you know, do a lot of work and have always done a lot of work in the US. And there have been so many clients over the years who I've never actually met in person. And yet we know all about each other's lives and everything else. And yet I've only ever seen them through a screen. I mean, but back even 2019, like I was working in a big corporate and we worked solely in the US and I hadn't even seen some of my clients because we just used to do that old school, like dial-in conference thing where we'd sit in, you know, in a meeting room and you'd have the little phone in the middle of the table. And everybody would just dial into it with a phone. We still didn't do video, which now just seems absolutely mind-blowing.
It's interesting how that it shifts from cultures, because when I was in Australia, we had clients all over the country, but the expected thing there was you got on a plane and you went and saw people. And that was 2017, 2018. But it was, there it was very face-to-face. It was, that's a big country to have to shuttle around in, but
that is a big
country. You do business there.
Wow. Well, look, Matt, is there somewhere where people can find you and find Chloris?
So for Chloris, the best place to go is our website, which is Chloris with a K. It's KLORISCBD.com. And the easiest place to find me is probably LinkedIn, and it's Matt McNeil with two L's.
Perfect. Look, I will post links to both of them in the show notes so people can get a hold of them. But Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jason. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thanks, Matt.